We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, lots to cover. Very busy week news-wise. So let's start with local and no charges being brought against Ian Burke.
Yeah, King County Prosecutor Dan Satterberg came out this week and announced that he was not filing any charges against Officer Ian Burke in the shooting of Native American woodcarver John T. Williams. Now, Satterberg had some options. He could have filed charges for second-degree murder, first-degree reckless manslaughter, or second-degree negligent manslaughter. For second-degree murder, he would have had to show that Burke intended to kill Williams or intentionally assaulted him. To file charges of manslaughter, he would have had to show that that Burke acted with reckless or negligent conduct. What I find interesting is that, in addition, the state law says that you have to prove, in the case of a police officer, that he acted with malice, a vague term that can be interpreted many different ways. Now, Satterberg said that it was clear in his mind that Burke wasn't acting in self-defense. Okay, not acting in self-defense. Well, then the question becomes, how then did the gun go off? It didn't misfire. Nobody is claiming that that happened. It's very clear that he actually pursued Williams, and Satterberg said, by his own actions, Officer Burke closed the distance between himself and the man with the knife. Of course, he couldn't call Williams by his name. He became the man with the knife. But in being very clear that Burke closed the distance, that he pursued Williams, that he wasn't acting in self-defense, that he shot him, it would seem to be clear that he attacked Williams. In other words, I don't think manslaughter would have been warranted, but charges of second-degree murder that Burke intended to kill Williams or intentionally assaulted him, that would have been very clear to me that it was Satterberg's job to bring those kinds of charges.
Well, no, because he would have had to have been confident. This is I don't blame Satterberg for this. I blame the law and the way the law is written, because it's an impossible standard. It is an impossible standard to prove that a police officer acted with personal malice toward the person that he shot. You would have to establish that that he knew who Williams was and that he had malice toward him. And you'd have to establish that beyond a reasonable doubt. And there's almost no way to do that.
I don't think so. I do blame Satterberg. I think that it is a poorly written law, but that does not let him off the hook from at least making the attempt to give Williams' family a day in court to try to show that, and keep in mind, too, here that the Seattle Police Department, the Firearms Review Board, came back and said that Burke didn't follow policy. He didn't follow his training, that it was an egregious case.
That's very different from meeting the standard under the law for those charges.
Yes, I know. But how do we know whether or not you can prove malice if no one tries? And I think that not only did Satterberg deprive the Williams family of their day in court, he also deprived the citizens of the state of Washington from their day in court to try to challenge a law that is badly written. And you know, you can talk all you want about how difficult it is to get a win in that kind of a case, but how do we know unless somebody tries, unless they actually challenge the law?
Well, if it's Satterberg's judgment that it's an impossible case to win, in that case, at least in my opinion, he is bound not to bring the case.
Well, I was really disturbed by some of the things that he said.
Oh, I was too.
Excusing himself.
Let me make it clear that I think that the law should allow police officers to be charged for this kind of an incident, but basically right now it doesn't.
I don't agree with that. And what I really was disturbed by was Satterberg's statement, not that this was an attack, but that Burke made strategic errors. I found that to be really offensive.
Yes, and I totally agree with that.
And coming from that kind of a perspective, I really saw this as that as his excuse for not filing charges, and really sort of showed that it's not just the law that's to blame; it's the people who are charged with enforcing the law and with you know, trying to oversee the police. Those folks are not doing a good job. And I want to talk a little bit about the demonstrators in the street. because they've gotten a lot of media coverage, that you know, sure, you can protest the police department, and the media is going to say, going to make it sound like, well, what can the police department do? They're talking to the mayor to try to make changes there in the way officers are trained, et cetera. And Burke wasn't following his training. But the police department could be doing more. They could be meeting not just with the mayor, but meeting with the city council and with the public to let us know what kind of changes they're making. And they could be saying, okay, yes, maybe the Office of Professional Accountability is not enough. Maybe we do need a civilian review board. And the city council and the mayor could be talking about that, and they're not.
Well, I think it's an even bigger issue than that, because it's not just the Williams shooting. There's a whole pattern of behavior, of which the Williams shooting is the most egregious example, because lethal force was involved.
Right.
But it's certainly not the only example where the training and culture of the Seattle Police Department has been out of control recently, and the Seattle Police Department has not taken responsibility for those incidents. And, you know, when you talk about that, then that and not just the Williams shooting is why there is so much community anger and so much community mistrust.
Yeah, and we're not getting that message from the media. What we're getting is that, oh, this is all about the Williams shooting. The Williams shooting is just kind of the culmination of a lot of discontent with the police department.
All right. Let's move on to Mayor Mike McGinn. Casting a vote this week.
Yeah, this week Mayor McGinn vetoed the city council's tunnel agreements. Well, nobody was surprised, because McGinn has been saying for a while that he was going to veto those agreements. What I find kind of interesting is that the city council passed those agreements 8-1 and will probably override the vetoes in late February. But you know, the media hasn't really covered it much and hasn't really talked about McGinn's reasons why. They haven't discussed the fact that the draft environmental impact statement for the tunnel, again, it's a draft environmental impact statement because a project that everyone believes is going to start construction this summer does not have a final environmental impact statement yet, that the draft environmental impact statement is so vague that it's caused the feds who control the property of the federal building, which the tunnel will be going under, the downtown federal building, are extremely alarmed by some of the things that they have read in that environmental impact statement that could have a serious effect in undermining their property. So, you know, I think it's kind of interesting that that's going on and that that's not getting any media coverage at all, that it's just, oh, one man, the mayor, standing up to everybody else in the state who wants this tunnel. And
yeah,
no
although,
one is mentioning
that
Seattle voters didn't want the tunnel either.
Well, they certainly mentioned why McGinn opposed it. I mean, he's a hippie and he rides a bicycle. How much more do you need to know?
He and City Council Member O'Brien, who also opposes the tunnel.
And is also a hippie who rides a bicycle.
And is also a hippie who rides a bicycle.
As is the federal government. They're also hippies who ride bicycles.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
Right. Well, you know, except for the ones who aren't.
Don't we wish?
All right, let's move on to the state level and talking about budget proposals and cuts this week.
Yeah, interesting report out from our Economic Future Coalition talking about, in the context of a legislative session in which there is a $4.6 billion expected revenue shortfall, which isn't certainly going to be made up by additional revenue. It's going to be made up entirely of cuts to the budget. Nonetheless, there have been $97 million and more in new tax breaks introduced this budget session. Those tax breaks, of course, all for corporate clients. For instance, a new tax exemption on the sale of beer from small domestic breweries, more tax incentives for Boeing, the aerospace industry, and a new B&O tax exemption for some in-state manufacturers. Millions and millions of dollars of this stuff. Now, a lot of this is not going to pass because of the budget implications, but it really tells you where legislators who introduce these kind of bills are coming from when they talk out of both sides of their mouth. On the one hand, about promoting fiscal responsibility, on the other hand, about, well, we all have to make sacrifices. Well, no, their favorite corporate patrons don't have to make sacrifices. In fact, they're encouraged to take even more out of the till. And it leads you to one of two conclusions. Either these legislatures really believe in trickle-down economics and the completely discredited economic idea that if you give people tax breaks, it will stimulate the economy and spur more revenue. That simply is not true. Or maybe they're just cynical and trying to play both sides of the aisle. That's also within the realm of possibility.
Yeah, it's interesting. They don't want to talk about how cutting jobs in state government is affecting the economy. They want to talk about how tax credits, which these businesses won't be able to realize the benefits of for a while, are a stimulus to the economy, when in fact the reverse is true. The tax credits have not been proven to be a stimulus to the economy. They were passed out like candy during the good times, and they're not taking any of them back during the bad times. Instead, they're going to cut jobs, which we know will directly affect the economy.
And we'll see this at the national level also when we get to talking about what's going on in Wisconsin and also at the federal level with the budget, where when people talk about cutting government jobs, it's not like it's adding to unemployment or anything, because those aren't real jobs.
All right. Well, anything else on that?
No, let's move on.
Okay, let's move on to national, and a lot happening in Wisconsin.
Yeah, the Wisconsin Governor Walker proposing this week, and got a little bit of a reaction to it. The dismantling of collective bargaining rights for state employees in that state. Now, this was done in the context of a state budget shortfall, very similar to the Washington State's budget shortfall, except in the case of Washington State, a state with roughly similar budget size and population, they're looking at a $4.6 billion shortfall. In Wisconsin, it's only $137 million, and the Republicans that control the state legislature and the governor's office just gave away $117 million in tax cuts, new tax cuts, last month. Not only that, but the elimination of collective bargaining rights really wouldn't affect the budget, certainly not in the short term. So what's going on here? Well, what's going on here basically is an ideological peeve of a lot of Republicans that unions exist at all. And that's the struggle, and it's really it's led to a huge national discussion of, well, along the line of, well, if unions are legitimate because they're meant to be a counterweight to the greed of greedy corporate owners, then what are public unions supposed to be a counterweight to? Well, what they're a counterweight to, at least when they became popular in the 1960s and 1970s, was that public sector wages tended to lag far behind the wages of private sector employees. They didn't get paid nearly as much, their benefits weren't nearly as good, and there was a lot of public sympathy for the public sector unions at that point, because they recognized that federal and state and local and municipal workers were getting a raw deal. That's changed over the last 40 years, and the political way in which they're viewed has been changed, not because of anything the public sector has done, but because the private sector has failed employees and workers so badly over the last 40 years. Wages have backslid, benefits have been slashed, job security has evaporated, whereas in the public sector, it's still a relatively stable job, and in fact, at this point, it's really one of the last places where you can get decent benefits in a relatively stable, protected job. And so you've got these conservatives going, well, look, why should you pay out of your pocket to have these employees living fat off the hog when you yourself don't have a secure job, etc.? That's not a problem with the public employees. That's a problem with the private sector, and workers should be demanding not that public workers get less, but that the private sector employees be getting more.
Yes and no.
Okay.
I agree with that a little bit, but disagree with it in some respects too. Now, there's a movement among all of the states and among the state governors to try to cut employee benefits to public sector workers, not just to bust their unions, but to cut into the health care benefits and the pension benefits for public sector employees. This kind of falls into what we've been talking about in the last few weeks here.
Although that can be negotiated. That can be done without dismantling the unions entirely.
Right. With these trust funds. Now, what they do with the money that is set aside for public workers' benefits, they put it into a trust fund, and those trust funds are starting to run to zero. And some states have deficits. The total deficits among the states this year are about $555 billion that they have to come up with in order to fund employee health care benefits and pension and retiree health care benefits, et cetera. And so they're saying, well, if we cut benefits for new employees, new public sector employees, that will help fill that gap. Of course, to do that, that means they have to break the public employee unions to do that. Well, there's this perception that public employees make decent wages and have decent benefits. However, studies have been done that show that in the last few years, public sector unions have given up on wage increases Yeah. in order to maintain a lot of the benefits that public sector employees enjoy, including plain old basic, in a lot of cases, very basic medical coverage.
Yeah, it's absolutely true.
And when other studies have been done that looked at the combination of wages and benefits for public sector employees versus private sector employees with equivalent educational and work experience, and they found that public sector employees are still underpaid. Even when you take into account their benefits, that if they got a job in the private sector, they would make more. That's exactly the reverse of what the perception is that, oh, these people are living high off the hog on the public dollar. That's still not the case.
All right. Okay, let's move on to the House Republicans having some amendments for the budget.
Yeah, the Congress, in order for the United States not to default on its debt because they have not managed to pass a budget for the coming year yet, need to pass a continuing resolution by March 4th to avoid a shutdown of the government. And we'll talk a little bit about what a shutdown of the government means in a minute. But in order to do that, both the House and the Senate need to pass that continuing resolution. And the House Republicans, because they're dedicated to shutting down the government, have been loading up their legislation with amendments that they know that the Senate and President Obama will not begin to pass. And one of the most egregious that was done this week was a resolution that would basically pull all federal funding for health care goes through Planned Parenthood. Now, bear in mind, this is not funding that goes toward abortion services. This is funding that goes toward family planning and contraception for women's reproductive health. In other words, it's basically an attack on women's health, one that is really unprecedented in the history of federal funding for health care at all. It would also eliminate the entire Title X program, which requires that the federal government spend money on women's health care. To begin with, it's founded in 1970 and the only federal grant program dedicated solely to providing individuals at all with comprehensive family planning and preventative services, particularly to low-income families. So these are the kind of amendments that the Republicans are putting on it, and this is why we will have a government shutdown on March 4th. Now, if you are dependent on, say, Social Security, or if you get food stamps, or if you get Medicare or VA benefits or anything like that, be prepared to go without them for a while, because as of March 4th, the Republicans are hell-bent on shutting down the federal government and proving that it can all fit into the size of a bathtub. It's going to be very, very difficult on a lot of people, and as we've seen at the state level also, you literally had the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, getting on television this week and saying, well, if it damages the economy, if it costs jobs, so be it. They don't care about costing jobs, even in the worst economic situation for employment in generations.
All right. Let's move on to international and developments, starting with developments in Bahrain.
Yeah, in Bahrain, our ally in the war on terror became a terrorist nation this week, as if there hadn't been problems in Bahrain already. But they attacked peaceful protesters with live bullets, with heavy tear gas, and even used anti-aircraft weapons to try to disperse crowds, in addition to American-made helicopters that had been sold to Bahrain, which as of Friday, were firing on crowds in Bahrain. What kills me is that the media is trying to make this out as a Shiite versus Sunni squabble, because the government is run by a Sunni monarchy, and it's a majority Shiite country with about 70% of its population are Shiite. And it's well known that the ruler of Bahrain tends to recruit police officers from abroad, from other Sunni populations in other parts of the Middle East, because he doesn't trust any Shiites to join the police or the military. But that may be true. However, you have a lot of Sunni demonstrators in the street, too, because in 2001, the electorate passed a charter that was supposed to lead eventually to a democracy in Bahrain. And a year later, the king of Bahrain decided to set aside that charter and institute his own constitution. The current prime minister of Bahrain has been in office for 40 years. So the demonstrators on Monday initially started by asking for the ouster of the prime minister from his sinecure, and the establishment of a democracy. And they ended the week by demanding, after all of the violence against them, after the dozens of people who have been shot, men, women, and children, they ended the week by demanding the overthrow of the entire government, the ouster of the ruling family, and a change, you know, complete change in regime in Bahrain.
Yeah, and mind you, Bahrain is the most egregious, but it's hardly the only example in the Middle East this week of governments firing on their own protesters or otherwise using violence against them. You also had that happen in Iran, in Yemen, in Algeria, in Libya, and you know it's been. And there have also been protests in Jordan and Syria as well. Now, mind you, it's been very interesting to watch the American media coverage of this, such as it's been, because the coverage once again has been dreadful, and you really have to go to international coverage or Al Jazeera or outlets like that in order to get decent coverage. But the coverage that there has been has really focused a lot on Iran, because that's the government we don't like.
Yeah.
As opposed to, say, Bahrain, where they're making excuses or saying they're shocked, simply shocked, and not bothering to pull out those clips of Hillary Clinton saying how much progress toward democracy Bahrain has made recently.
Yeah.
There really is a double standard when it comes to American allies, very similar to what we saw in Egypt.
Bahrain is of strategic importance
to the
U.S. government.
The Fifth Fleet.
Because the Fifth Fleet is based there, and the Fifth Fleet is what ensures U.S. access and Western access to the oil shipping lanes in the Suez Canal and the Strait of Hormuz.
Of course, we saw that similar double standard in play with media coverage of Egypt also. And even now, when people are talking about what comes next in Egypt, they're talking about what comes next in terms of, the Egyptian cooperation in the war on terror, which of course is code word saying, well, they still torture our prisoners for us.
Yeah, no, there have been some good developments in Egypt over the week too, but there's a lot more that could be done. The military came out and announced that a 6-month timeline for elections and a 10-day timeline for making amendments to the Constitution. A lot of people immediately said, well, 10 days is not enough. However, there are constitutional scholars, judges, and lawyers in Egypt who have a plan already in place for changes they'd like to make to the Constitution. Many of those people are sitting on the council who are currently working on those changes, and they are moving forward to instituting some really good amendments to the Egyptian Constitution. And the fact that the military has announced a timeline for democratic elections is promising. However, a lot of human rights groups within Egypt are calling for the government to repeal martial law and to release a lot of the people who have been jailed in the last few weeks, and they haven't done that yet.
All right. Well, let's move a little closer to home, and some developments this week in regards to Ecuador.
Yeah, an Ecuadorian judge ruled this week in a 15-year case against Chevron for polluting the Ecuadorian rainforest to extract oil in the Amazon basin. The award against Chevron is $9 billion. Of course, the plaintiffs had asked for about $113 to $115 billion, so they're a little bit disappointed. They're also disappointed in the fact that Chevron doesn't have many assets in Ecuador, so it's going to be very difficult for them to collect on that judgment. But the plaintiffs are kind of getting down to the basics here and deciding, well, we're going to have to go after Chevron in the countries where it does have assets, in places like Brazil, Venezuela, and Argentina. They may file suit in places like the Philippines, in Singapore, in Australia, in Canada, Angola. They tried in the U.S. A U.S. judge last month ruled to set aside the judgment, at least temporarily, so that Chevron wouldn't have to pay a dime to the people who were harmed from the pollution that Chevron or Chevron's, better yet, the company that Chevron purchased, that Texaco left in the Ecuadorian in the Ecuadorian Amazon. But we'll see how it goes. It's a long-running case, and this is a good first step towards getting some justice for those folks.
Yeah. Now bear in mind, I mean, particularly given the precedent of the Exxon Valdez, we've seen that the lengths that these oil companies will go to avoid being collected on these judgments. And in this case, you know, they've got a lot more legal resources than the indigenous people of Ecuador
do.
However, this has also spawned a number of other cases that are a little bit farther down the pipeline of other indigenous people in other countries suing not just Chevron but all of these different oil companies for damages to the environment. And this, from the standpoint of a precedent of holding oil companies responsible for not just environmental damages but also damages to indigenous cultures and livelihoods, this is a tremendous precedent. And so from that standpoint, it's a very cheering news.
Yeah, it'd be nice to see things going forward in places like Nigeria and Angola, where the environmental devastation and the devastation to communities has just been so dramatic.
Also, you've never seen the U.S. Never seems to cooperate on these efforts in terms of, if you look at what happened at Bhopal, and India has tried to get the head of Union Carbide there to face charges, and the U.S. has denied allowing him to leave or
be extradited for
exactly.
that. Yeah.
All right. Developments with a replacement for Richard Holbrooke.
Yeah, Hillary Clinton named a replacement for Richard Holbrooke, the previous special envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan this week. His name is Mark Grossman, and he's got kind of a troubling history. He's been credibly accused by the Sunday Times of London of essentially being a secret agent for the government of Turkey in Middle Eastern affairs with the U.S. He was also a key player in the Valerie Plame affair. That's right. He was a former Bush administration official who, at the request of Scooter Liberty, had obtained the information that Joe Wilson's wife was actually a covert CIA operative and passed that information on to Bush administration officials, specifically Richard Armitage, who then turned and leaked it to Robert Novak. If people remember the detail of that chain of events that led to her public outing as retribution for her husband opposing the war and the invasion of Iraq. So he's got kind of a squirrely background, but this has been true of a lot of Hillary Clinton's associates recently. Given that she's just coming after the debacle of naming Frank Wisner, an old Clinton hand, to go to Egypt and talk about what a good buddy of ours, Hosni Mubarak, is and what a lover of freedom and democracy, which was definitely not the message that the Obama administration had wanted to convey at the time. You would think she would have been a little more sensitive to those sensibilities at this point, but nope, you know, you really can't change somebody's stripes, and that comes to Hillary Clinton as well.
All right. Events.
Yeah, we talked about the shooting of John T. Williams, and of course there was a protest of that in the streets of Seattle yesterday. There's another protest today that's kind of cool, which is that the Williams family and different Native American groups are holding a carve-in this afternoon at Victor Steinbrück Park, also known as Indian Park, in downtown Seattle, near the Pike Place Market. His brother, Rick Williams, advises that you bring clear cedar, preferably 1x10x12 inches, or 3x3x14, a small pocket of carving knife. Don't wield it at a police officer,
Keep it in your pocket until you get there.
That's right. A pencil and a sense of humor. And experienced traditional Native carvers will be on hand to teach beginning wood carving, too, which is very cool. So that's from 1 to 5 o'clock today at Victor Steinbrück Park. Go and check it out. It should be a nice sunny day. Enjoy it.
All right. Talking as we do every week with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This State. And where do people find Eat This State?
www.eatthestate.org is where you find humor, columns, stories, opinion, blogs, all that kind of good stuff. Local, national, international. Go and check it out. www.eatthestate.org.